Chapter 2. Who else is reading your email? If you're like me, one of the first things you do in the morning is check your email. And if you're like me, you also wonder, who else has read your email? That's not a paranoid concern. If you use a web-based email service such as Gmail or Outlook 365, the answer is kind of obvious and frightening. Even if you delete an email the moment you read it on your computer or mobile phone, that doesn't necessarily erase the content. There's still a copy of it somewhere. Webmail is cloud-based, so in order to be able to access it from any device, anywhere, at any time, there have to be redundant copies. If you use Gmail, for example, a copy of every email sent and received through your Gmail account is retained on various servers worldwide at Google. This is also true if you use email systems provided by Yahoo, Apple, AT&T, Comcast, Microsoft, or even your workplace. Any emails you send can also be inspected at any time by the hosting company. Allegedly, this is to filter out malware, but the reality is that third parties can and do access our emails for other, more sinister and self-serving reasons. In principle, most of us would never stand for anyone except the intended recipient reading our mail. There are laws protecting printed mail delivered through the U.S. Postal Service and laws protecting stored content such as email. Yet, in practice, we usually know and probably accept that there's a certain trade-off involved in the ease of communication email affords. We know that Yahoo, among others, offers a free webmail service, and we know that Yahoo makes the majority of its money from advertising. Perhaps we've not realized exactly how the two might be connected and how that might affect our privacy. One day, Stuart Diamond, a resident of Northern California, did. He realized that the ads he saw in the upper right-hand corner of his Yahoo Mail client were not random. They were based on the contents of the emails he had been sending and receiving. For example, if I mentioned in an email an upcoming speaking trip to Dubai, the ads I might see in my email account would suggest airlines, hotels, and things to do while in the United Arab Emirates. This practice is usually carefully spelled out in the terms of service that most of us agreed to, but probably never read. Nobody wants to see ads that have nothing to do with our individual interests, right? And as long as the email travels between Yahoo account holders, it seems reasonable that the company would be able to scan the contents of those emails in order to target ads to us and maybe block malware and spam, which is unwanted email. However, Diamond, along with David Sutton, also from Northern California, began to notice that the contents of emails sent to and received from addresses outside Yahoo also influenced the ad selection presented to them. That suggested that the company was intercepting and reading all their email, not just those sent to and from its own servers. Based on the patterns they observed, the two filed a class action lawsuit in 2012 against Yahoo on behalf of its 275 million account holders, citing concerns around what is essentially equivalent to illegal wiretapping by the company. Did that end the scanning? No. In a class action suit, there is a period of discovery and response from both parties. In this case, that initial phase lasted nearly 3 years. In June of 2015, a judge in San Jose, California, ruled that the men had sufficient grounds for their class action suit to proceed and that people who sent or received Yahoo Mail since October 2, 2011, when the men filed their initial request, could join in the lawsuit under the Stored Communications Act. Additionally, a class of non-Yahoo Mail account holders living in California may also sue under that state's Invasion of Privacy Act. That case is still pending. In defending itself against another email scanning lawsuit, this one filed early in 2014, Google accidentally published information about its email scanning process in a court hearing, then quickly attempted and failed to have that information redacted or removed. The case involved the question of precisely what was scanned or read by Google. According to the plaintiffs in the case, which included several large media companies, including the owners of USA Today, Google realized at some point that by scanning only the contents of the inbox, they were missing a lot of potentially useful content. This suit alleged that Google shifted from scanning only archived email, which resides on the Google server, to scanning all Gmail still in transit, whether it was sent from an iPhone or a laptop while the user was sitting in Starbucks. Sometimes companies have even tried to secretly scan emails for their own purposes. One well-known instance of this happened at Microsoft, which suffered a huge backlash when it revealed that it had scanned the inbox of a Hotmail user who was suspected of having pirated a copy of company's software. As a result of this disclosure, Microsoft has said it will let law enforcement handle such investigations in the future. These practices aren't limited to your private email. If you send email through your work network, your company's IT department may also be scanning and archiving your communications. It is up to the IT staff or their managers whether to let any flagged email pass through their servers and networks or involve law enforcement. This includes emails that contain trade secrets or questionable materials, such as pornography. It also includes scanning email for malware. If your IT staff is scanning and archiving your emails, they should remind you each time you log in what their policy is, although most companies do not. While most of us may tolerate having our emails scanned for malware, and perhaps some of us tolerate scanning for advertising purposes, the idea of third parties reading our correspondence and acting on specific contents found within specific emails is downright disturbing. Except, of course, when it comes to child pornography. So, whenever you write an email, no matter how inconsequential, and even if you delete it from your inbox, remember that there's an excellent chance that a copy of those words and images will be scanned and will live on. Maybe not forever, but for a good long while. Some companies may have short retention policies, but it's safe to assume that most companies keep email for a long time. Now that you know the government and corporations are reading your emails, the least you can do is make it much harder for them to do so. Most web-based email services use encryption when the email is in transit. However, when some services transmit mail between mail transfer agents, MTA, they may not be using encryption. Thus, your message is in the open. For example, within the workplace, a boss may have access to the company email system. To become invisible, you will need to encrypt your messages, that is, lock them, so that only the recipients can unlock and read them. What is encryption? It is a code. A very simple encryption example, a Caesar cipher, say, substitutes each letter for another one a certain number of positions away in the alphabet. If that number is 2, for example, then using a Caesar cipher, A becomes C, C becomes E, Z becomes B, and so forth. Using this offset by 2 encryption scheme, Kevin Mitnick becomes MGXKPOKVPKEM. Most encryption systems used today are, of course, much stronger than any basic Caesar cipher. Therefore, they should be much harder to break. One thing that's true about all forms of encryption is that they require a key, which is used as a password to lock and open the encrypted message. Symmetrical encryption means that the same key is used both to lock and unlock the encrypted message. Symmetrical keys are hard to share, however, when two parties are unknown to each other or physically far apart, as they are on the Internet. Most email encryption actually uses what's called asymmetrical encryption. That means I generate 2 keys, a private key that stays on my device, which I never share, and a public key that I post freely on the Internet. The 2 keys are different, yet mathematically related. For example, Bob wants to send Alice a secure email. He finds Alice's public key on the Internet, or obtains it directly from Alice, and when sending a message to her, encrypts the message with her key. This message will stay encrypted until Alice, and only Alice, uses a passphrase to unlock her private key and unlock the encrypted message. So, how would encrypting the contents of your email work? The most popular method of email encryption is PGP, which stands for Pretty Good Privacy. It's not free. It is a product of the Symantec Corporation, but its creator, Phil Zimmerman, also authored an open-source version, OpenPGP, which is free. And a third option, GPG, GNU Privacy Guard, created by Werner Koch, is also free. The good news is that all three are interoperational. That means that no matter which version of PGP you use, the basic functions are the same. When Edward Snowden first decided to disclose the sensitive data he'd copied from the NSA, he needed the assistance of like-minded people scattered around the world. Paradoxically, he needed to get off the grid while still remaining active on the internet. He needed to become invisible. Even if you don't have state secrets to share, you might be interested in keeping your emails private. Snowden's experience and that of others illustrate that it isn't easy to do that, but it is possible with proper diligence. Snowden used his personal account through a company called LavaBit to communicate with others, but email is not point-to-point, meaning that a single email might hit several servers around the world before landing in the intended recipient's inbox. Snowden knew that whatever he wrote could be read by anyone who intercepted the email anywhere along its journey. So, he had to perform a complicated maneuver to establish a truly secure, anonymous, and fully encrypted means of communication with privacy advocate and filmmaker Laura Poitras, who had recently finished a documentary about the lives of whistleblowers. Snowden wanted to establish an encrypted exchange with Poitras, except only a few people knew her public key. She didn't make her public key very public. To find her public key, Snowden had to reach out to a third party, Michael Lee of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a group that supports privacy online. Lee's public key was available online, and according to the account published on The Intercept, an online publication, he had Poitras' public key, but he first needed to check to see if she would permit him to share it. She would. At this point, neither Lee nor Poitras had any idea who wanted her public key. They only knew that someone did. Snowden had used a different account, not his personal email account, to reach out. But if you don't use PGP often, you may forget to include your PGP key on important emails now and again. And that is what happened to Snowden. He had forgotten to include his own public key so Lee could reply. With no secure way to contact this mystery person, Lee was left with no choice but to send a plain text, unencrypted email back to Snowden asking for his public key, which he provided. Once again, Lee, a trusted third party, had to be brought into the situation. I can tell you from personal experience that it is very important to verify the identity of the person with whom you are having a secure conversation, preferably through a mutual friend. And make sure you are communicating with that friend and not someone else in disguise. I know how important this is because I've been the poser before, in a situation where it worked to my advantage that the other party didn't question my real identity or the public key I sent. I once wanted to communicate with Neil Clift, a graduate student in organic chemistry at the University of Leeds in England, who was very skilled at finding security vulnerabilities in the Digital Equipment Corporation's VMS operating system. I wanted Clift to send me all the security holes that he'd reported to DEC. For that, I needed him to think that I actually worked for DEC. I started by posing as someone named Dave Hutchins and sending Clift a spoofed message from him. I had previously called Clift pretending to be Daryl Piper from VMS Engineering, so I, posing as Hutchins, wrote in my email that Piper wanted to exchange emails with Clift about a project. In going through DEC's email system, I already knew that Clift and the real Piper had previously emailed each other, so this new request wouldn't sound all that odd. I then sent an email spoofing Piper's real email address. To further convince Clift this was all on the up and up, I even suggested that he use PGP encryption so that someone like Kevin Mitnick wouldn't be able to read the emails. Soon, Clift and Piper were exchanging public keys and encrypting communications, communications that I, as Piper, could read. Clift's mistake was in not questioning the identity of Piper himself. Similarly, when you receive an unsolicited phone call from your bank asking for your social security number or account information, you should always hang up and call the bank yourself. You never know who is on the other side of the phone call or email. Given the importance of the secrets they were about to share, Snowden and Poitras could not use their regular email addresses. Why not? Their personal email accounts contained unique associations, such as specific interests, lists of contacts, that could identify each of them. Instead, Snowden and Poitras decided to create new email addresses. The only problem was, how would they know each other's new email addresses? In other words, if both parties were totally anonymous, how would they know who was who and whom they could trust? How could Snowden, for example, rule out the possibility that the NSA or someone else wasn't posing as Poitras's new email account? Public keys are long, so you can't just pick up a secure phone and read out the characters to the other person. You need a secure email exchange. By enlisting Michael Lee, once again, both Snowden and Poitras could anchor their trust in someone when setting up their new and anonymous email accounts. Poitras first shared her new public key with Lee. But PGP encryption keys themselves are rather long. Not quite pi length, but they are long. And again, what if someone were watching his email account as well? So, Lee did not use the actual key, but instead a 40-character abbreviation, or a fingerprint, of Poitras' public key. This he posted to a public site, Twitter. Sometimes, in order to become invisible, you have to use the visible. Now, Snowden could anonymously view Lee's tweet and compare the shortened key to the message he received. If the two didn't match, Snowden would know not to trust the email. The message might have been compromised, or he might be talking instead to the NSA. In this case, the two matched. Now, several orders removed from who they were online and where they were in the world, Snowden and Poitras were almost ready to begin their secure anonymous email communication. Snowden finally sent Poitras an encrypted email identifying himself only as Citizen 4. This signature became the title of her Academy Award-winning documentary about his privacy rights campaign. That might seem like the end. Now they could communicate securely via encrypted email. But it wasn't. It was just the beginning. In the wake of the 2015 terrorist attacks in Paris, there was discussion from various governments about building in back doors or other ways for those in government to decrypt encrypted email, text, and phone messages, ostensibly from foreign terrorists. This would, of course, defeat the purpose of encryption, but governments actually don't need to see the encrypted contents of your email to know whom you are communicating with and how often, as we will see. As I mentioned before, the purpose of encryption is to encode your message so that only someone with the correct key can later decode it. Both the strength of the mathematical operation and the length of the encryption key determine how easy it is for someone without a key to crack your code. Encryption algorithms in use today are public. You want that. Be afraid of encryption algorithms that are proprietary and not public. Public algorithms have been vetted for weakness, meaning people have been purposely trying to break them. Whenever one of the public algorithms becomes weak or is cracked, it is retired, and newer, stronger algorithms are used instead. The older algorithms still exist, but their use is strongly discouraged. The keys are more or less under your control, and so, as you might guess, their management is very important. If you generate an encryption key, you and no one else will have the key stored on your device. If you let a company perform the encryption, say, in the cloud, then that company might also keep the key after he or she shares it with you. The real concern is that this company may also be compelled by court order to share the key with law enforcement or a government agency with or without a warrant. You will need to read the privacy policy for each service you use for encryption and understand who owns the keys. When you encrypt a message, an email, text, or phone call, use end-to-end encryption. That means your message stays unreadable until it reaches its intended recipient. With end-to-end encryption, only you and your recipient have the keys to decode the message, not the telecommunications carrier, website owner, or app developer, the parties that law enforcement or government will ask to turn over information about you. How do you know whether the encryption service you are using is end-to-end encryption? Do a Google search for end-to-end encryption voice call. If the app or service doesn't use end-to-end encryption, then choose another. If all this sounds complicated, that's because it is. But there are PGP plugins for the Chrome and Firefox internet browsers that make encryption easier. One is Mailvelope, which neatly handles the public and private encryption keys of PGP. Simply type in a passphrase, which will be used to generate the public and private keys. Then, whenever you write a web-based email, select a recipient, and if the recipient has a public key available, you will then have the option to send that person an encrypted message. Even if you encrypt your email messages with PGP, a small but information-rich part of your message is still readable by just about anyone. In defending itself from the Snowden revelations, the U.S. government stated repeatedly that it doesn't capture the actual contents of our emails, which in this case would be unreadable with PGP encryption. Instead, the government said it collects only the email's metadata. What is email metadata? It is the information in the to and from fields, as well as the IP addresses of the various servers that handle the email from origin to recipient. It also includes the subject line, which can sometimes be very revealing as to the encrypted contents of the message. Metadata, a legacy from the early days of the internet, is still included on every email sent and received, but modern email readers hide this information from display. PGP. No matter what flavor you use, it does not encrypt the metadata, the to and from fields, the subject line, and the timestamp information. This remains in plain text, whether it is visible to you or not. Third parties will still be able to see the metadata of your encrypted message. They'll know that on such and such a date you sent an email to someone, that 2 days later you sent another email to that same person, and so on. That might sound okay, since the third parties are not actually reading the content, and you probably don't care about the mechanics of how those emails traveled, the various server addresses and the timestamps, but you'd be surprised by how much can be learned from the email path and the frequency of emails alone. Back in the 90s, before I went on the run from the FBI, I performed what I called a metadata analysis on various phone records. I began this process by hacking into Pactel Cellular, a cellular provider in Los Angeles, to obtain the call detail records, CDRs, of anyone who called an informant whom the FBI was using to obtain information about my activities. CDRs are very much like the metadata I'm talking about here. They show the time a phone call was made, the number dialed, the length of the call, and the number of times a particular number was called. All very useful information. By searching through the calls that were being placed through Pactel Cellular to the informant's landline, I was able to obtain a list of the cell phone numbers of the people who called him. Upon analysis of the caller's billing records, I was able to identify those callers as members of the FBI's white-collar crime squad operating out of the Los Angeles office. Sure enough, some of the numbers each individual dialed were internal to the Los Angeles office of the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and other government offices. Some of those calls were quite long and quite frequent. Whenever they moved the informant to a new safe house, I was able to obtain the landline number of the safe house because the agents would call it after trying to reach the informant on his pager. Once I had the landline number for the informant, I was also able to obtain the physical address through social engineering, that is, by pretending to be someone at Pacific Bell, the company that provided the service at the safe house. Social engineering is a hacking technique that uses manipulation, deception, and influence to get a human target to comply with a request. Often people are tricked into giving up sensitive information. In this case, I knew the internal numbers at the phone company, and I pretended to be a field technician who spoke the correct terminology and lingo, which was instrumental in obtaining sensitive information. So, while recording the metadata in an email is not the same as capturing the actual content, it is nonetheless intrusive from a privacy perspective. If you look at the metadata from any recent email, you'll see the IP addresses of the servers that passed your email around the world before it reached its target. Each server, like each person who accesses the internet, has a unique IP address, a numerical value that is calculated using the country where you are located and who your internet provider is. Blocks of IP addresses are set aside for various countries, and each provider has its own sub-block. and this is further subdivided by type of service, dial-up, cable, or mobile. If you purchased a static IP address, it will be associated with your subscriber account and home address. Otherwise, your external IP address will be generated from a pool of addresses assigned to your internet service provider. For example, a sender, someone sending you an email, might have the IP address 27.126.148.104, which is located in Victoria, Australia. Or it could be 175.45.176.0, which is one of North Korea's IP addresses. If it is the latter, then your email account might be flagged for government review. Someone in the U.S. government might want to know why you're communicating with someone from North Korea, even if the subject line reads, "Happy Birthday." By itself, you still might not think the server address is very interesting, but the frequency of contact can tell you a lot. Additionally, if you identify each element, the sender and the receiver and their locations, you can start to infer what's really going on. For example, the metadata associated with phone calls, the duration, the time of day they're made, and so on, can tell you a lot about a person's mental health. A 10 o'clock p.m. call to a domestic violence hotline lasting 10 minutes, or a midnight call from the Brooklyn Bridge to a suicide prevention hotline lasting 20 minutes can be very revealing. An app developed at Dartmouth College matches patterns of stress, depression, and loneliness in user data. This user activity has also been correlated with student grades. Still don't see the danger in having your email metadata exposed? A program created at MIT called Immersion will visually map the relationships between the senders and receivers of all the email you have stored in your email account just by using the metadata. The tool is a way to visually quantify who matters to you most. The program even includes a sliding time scale so you can see how the people you know rise and fall in importance to you over time. Although you might think you understand your relationships, seeing them graphically represented can be a sobering experience. You might not realize how often you email someone you don't really know, or how little you email someone you know very well. With the Immersion tool, you can choose whether to upload the data, and you can also delete the information once it has been graphed. According to Snowden, our email, text, and phone metadata is being collected by the NSA and other agencies. But the government can't collect metadata from everyone. Or can it? Technically, no. However, there's been a sharp rise in legal collections since 2001. Authorized under the U.S. Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, FISA, the U.S. Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, known as FISC or the FISA Court, oversees all requests for surveillance warrants against foreign individuals within the United States. On the surface, it seems reasonable that a court order would stand between law enforcement and an individual. The reality is somewhat different. In 2012 alone, 1,856 requests were presented and 1,856 requests were approved, suggesting that the process today is largely a rubber stamp approval operation for the U.S. government. After the FISA court grants a request, law enforcement can compel private corporations to turn over all their data on you, that is, if they haven't already done so. To become truly invisible in the digital world, you will need to do more than encrypt your messages. You will need to remove your true IP address. This is your point of connection to the internet, your fingerprint. It can show where you are, down to your physical address, and what provider you use. Obscure your hardware and software. When you connect to a website online, a snapshot of the hardware and software you're using may be collected on the site. There are tricks that can be used to find out if you have particular software installed, such as Adobe Flash. The browser software tells a website what operating system you're using, what version of that operating system you have, and sometimes what other software you have running on your desktop at the time. Defend your anonymity. Attribution online is hard. Proving that you were at the keyboard when an event occurred is difficult. However, if you walk in front of a camera before going online at Starbucks, or if you just bought a latte at Starbucks with your credit card, These actions can be linked to your online presence a few moments later. As we've learned, every time you connect to the internet, there's an IP address associated with that connection. This is problematic if you're trying to be invisible online. You might change your name or not give it at all, but your IP address will still reveal where you are in the world, what provider you use, and the identity of the person paying for the internet service, which may or may not be you. All these pieces of information are included within the email metadata and can later be used to identify you uniquely. Any communications, whether it's email or not, can be used to identify you based on the Internet Protocol IP address that's assigned to the router you are using while you are at home, work, or a friend's place. IP addresses in emails can, of course, be forged. Someone might use a proxy address, not his or her real IP address, but someone else's, so that an email appears to originate from another location. A proxy is like a foreign language translator. You speak to the translator, and the translator speaks to the foreign language speaker. Only the message remains exactly the same. The point here is that someone might use a proxy from China or even Germany to evade detection on an email that really comes from North Korea. Instead of hosting your own proxy, you can use a service known as an anonymous remailer, which will mask your email's IP address for you. An anonymous remailer simply changes the email address of the sender before sending the message to its intended recipient. The recipient can respond via the remailer. That's the simplest version. There are also variations. Some Type 1 and Type 2 remailers do not allow you to respond to emails. They are simply one-way correspondence. Type 3 or MixMinion remailers do offer a full suite of services, responding, forwarding, and encryption. You'll need to find out which service your remailer supplies if you choose this method of anonymous correspondence. One way to mask your IP address is to use the Onion Router, Tor, which is what Snowden and Poitras did. Developed by the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory in 2004 as a way for military personnel to conduct searches without exposing their physical locations, the Tor open source program has since been expanded. Tor is designed to be used by people living in harsh regimes as a way to avoid censorship of popular media and services and to prevent anyone from tracking what search terms they use. Tor remains free and can be used by anyone, anywhere, even you. How does Tor work? It upends the usual model for accessing a website. Usually when you go online, you open an internet browser and type in the name of the site you want to visit. A request goes out to that site, and milliseconds later, a response comes back to your browser with the website page. The website knows, based on the IP address, who the service provider is, and sometimes even where in the world you are located, based on where the service provider is located, or the latency of the hops from your device to the site. For example, if your device says it is in the United States, but the time and number of hops your request takes to reach its destination suggest you are somewhere else in the world, some sites, gaming sites in particular, will detect that as possible fraud. When you use Tor, the direct line between you and your target website is obscured by additional nodes, and every 10 seconds, the chain of nodes connecting you to whatever site you are looking at changes without disruption to you. The various nodes that connect you to a site are like layers within an onion. In other words, if someone were to backtrack from the destination website and try to find you, they'd be unable to because the path would be constantly changing. Unless your entry point and your exit point become associated somehow, your connection is considered anonymous. When you use Tor, your request to open a page, say mitniksecurity.com, is not sent directly to that server, but first to another Tor node. And just to make things even more complicated, that node then passes the request to another node, which finally connects to mitniksecurity.com. So, there's an entry node, a node in the middle, and an exit node. If I were to look at who was visiting my company's site, I would only see the IP address and information from the exit node, the last in the chain, and not the first, your entry node. You can configure Tor so it uses exit nodes in a particular country, such as Spain, or even a specific exit node, perhaps in Honolulu. To use Tor, you will need the modified Firefox browser from the Tor site, torproject.org. Always look for legitimate Tor browsers for your operating system from the Tor Project website. Do not use a third-party site. For Android operating systems, Orbot is a legitimate free Tor app from Google Play that both encrypts your traffic and obscures your IP address. On iOS devices, iPad, iPhone, install the Onion browser, a legitimate app from the iTunes App Store. You might be thinking, why doesn't someone just build an email server within Tor? Someone did. Tor Mail was a service hosted on a site accessible only to Tor browsers. However, the FBI seized that server in an unrelated case and therefore gained access to all the encrypted emails stored on Tor Mail. This is a cautionary tale showing that even when you think your information is safe, foolproof, it probably isn't. Although Tor uses a special network, you can still access the internet from it, but the pages are much slower to load. However, in addition to allowing you to surf the searchable internet, Tor gives you access to a world of sites that are not ordinarily searchable, what's called the dark web. These are sites that don't resolve to common names such as Google.com and instead end with the .onion extension. Some of these hidden sites offer, sell, or provide items and services that may be illegal. Some of them are legitimate sites maintained by people in oppressed parts of the world. It should be noted, however, that there are several weaknesses with Tor. You have no control over the exit nodes, which may be under the control of government or law enforcement. You can still be profiled and possibly identified. Tor is very slow. That being said, if one still decides to use Tor, one should not run it in a same physical device that you use for browsing. In other words, have a laptop for browsing the web and a separate device for Tor. For instance, a Raspberry Pi mini computer running Tor software. The idea here is that if somebody is able to compromise your laptop, they still won't be able to peel off your Tor transport layer as it is running on a separate physical box. In the case of Snowden and Poitras, as I said, simply connecting to each other over encrypted email wasn't good enough. After Poitras created a new public key for her anonymous email account, she could have sent it to Snowden's previous email address, but if someone were watching that account, then her new identity would be exposed. A very basic rule is that you have to keep your anonymous accounts completely separate from anything that could relate back to your true identity. To be invisible, you will need to start with a clean slate for each new secure contact you make. Legacy email accounts might be connected in various ways to other parts of your life, friends, hobbies, work. To communicate in secrecy, you will need to create new email accounts using Tor so that the IP address setting up the account is not associated with your real identity in any way. Creating anonymous email addresses is challenging, but possible. There are private email services you can use. Since you will leave a trail if you pay for those services, you're actually better off using a free web service. A minor hassle. Gmail, Microsoft, Yahoo, and others require you to supply a phone number to verify your identity. Obviously, you can't use your real cell phone number since it may be connected to your real name and real address. You might be able to set up a Skype phone number if it supports voice authentication instead of SMS authentication. However, you will still need an existing email account and a prepaid gift card to set up a Skype number. If you think using a prepaid cell phone in and of itself will protect your anonymity, you're wrong. If you've ever used a prepaid phone to make calls associated with your real identity, it's child's play to discover who you are. Instead, you'll want to use a disposable phone. Some people think of burner phones as devices used only by terrorists, pimps, and drug dealers, but there are plenty of perfectly legitimate uses for them. For example, a business reporter, after having her garbage gone through by private investigators hired by Hewlett-Packard, who was eager to find out who might be leaking critical board of directors information, switched over to burner phones so that the private investigators would have a harder time identifying her calls. After that experience, she only spoke to her source on that burner phone. Similarly, a woman who is avoiding an abusive ex might gain a little peace of mind by using a phone that doesn't require a contract, or, for that matter, a Google or an Apple account. A burner phone typically has few or very limited internet capabilities. Burner phones mostly provide voice, text, and email service, and that's about all some people need. You, however, should also get data because you can tether this burner phone to your laptop and use it to surf the internet. On page 117, I tell you how to change the Media Access Control, MAC address on your laptop so that each time you tether with a burner phone, it appears to be a new device. However, purchasing a burner phone anonymously will be tricky. Actions taken in the real world can be used to identify you in the virtual world. Sure, I could walk into Walmart and pay cash for a burner phone and 100 minutes of airtime. Who would know? Well, lots of people would. First, how did I get to Walmart? Did I take an Uber car? Did I take a taxi? These records can all be subpoenaed. I could drive my own car, but law enforcement uses automatic license plate recognition technology, ALPR, in large public parking lots to look for missing and stolen vehicles, as well as people on whom there are outstanding warrants. The ALPR records can be subpoenaed. Even if I walked to Walmart, once I entered the store, my face would be visible on several security cameras within the store itself, and that video can be subpoenaed. Okay. So, let's say I send someone else to the store. Someone I don't know, maybe a homeless person I hired on the spot. That person walks in and buys the phone and several data refill cards with cash. That would be the safest approach. Maybe you arrange to meet this person later away from the store. This would help physically distance yourself from the actual sales transaction. In this case, the weakest link could still be the person you sent. How trustworthy is he? If you pay him more than the value of the phone, he will probably be happy to deliver the phone as promised. Activation of the prepaid phone requires either calling the mobile operator's customer service department or activating it on the provider's website. To avoid being recorded for quality assurance, it's safer to activate over the web. Using Tor over an open wireless network after you've changed your MAC address should be the minimum safeguards. You should make up all the subscriber information you enter on the website. For your address, just Google the address of a major hotel and use that. Make up a birth date and PIN that you'll remember in case you need to contact customer service in the future. There are email services that don't require verification, and if you don't need to worry about authorities, Skype numbers work well for Google account registration and similar stuff. But for the sake of illustration, let's say that after using Tor to randomize your IP address and after creating a Gmail account that has nothing to do with your real phone number, Google sends your phone a verification code or a voice call. Now you have a Gmail account that is virtually untraceable. So, we have an anonymous email address established using familiar and common services. We can produce reasonably secure emails whose IP address, thanks to Tor, is anonymous, although you don't have control over the exit notes, and whose contents, thanks to PGP, can't be read except by the intended recipient. Note that to keep this account anonymous, you can only access the account from within Tor so that your IP address will never be associated with it. Further, you should never perform any internet searches while logged into that anonymous Gmail account. You might inadvertently search for something that is related to your true identity. Even searching for weather information could reveal your location. As you can see, becoming invisible and keeping yourself invisible require tremendous discipline and perpetual diligence. But it is worth it in order to be invisible. The most important takeaways are, first, be aware of all the ways that someone can identify you, even if you undertake some but not all the precautions I've described. And if you do undertake all these precautions, know that you need to perform due diligence every time you use your anonymous accounts, no exceptions. It's also worth reiterating that end-to-end encryption, keeping your message unreadable and secure until it reaches the recipient, as opposed to simply encrypting it, is very important. End-to-end encryption can be used for other purposes, such as encrypted phone calls and instant messaging, which we'll discuss in the next two chapters. Chapter 3. Wiretapping 101. You spend countless hours on your cell phone every day, chatting, texting, surfing the internet, but do you actually know how your cell phone works? Cellular service, which we use on our mobile devices, is wireless and relies upon cellular towers or base stations. To maintain connectivity, cell phones continually send out tiny beacons to the tower or towers physically closest to them. The signal response to those beacons from the towers translates into the number of bars you have. No bars, no signal. To protect the identity of the user somewhat, these beacons from your cell phone use what is known as International Mobile Subscriber Identity, or IMSI, an alphanumeric string. This is a legacy from the time when cellular networks needed to know when you were on their towers and when you were roaming using other carriers' cell towers. Part of the IMSI code identifies the carrier or service, and the other part is a unique identifier that the carrier can use to link to your billing information. Law enforcement has created devices that pretend to be cellular base stations. These are designed to intercept voice and text messages. In the United States, law enforcement and intelligence agencies also use other devices to catch IMSIs. The IMSI is captured instantly, in less than a second, and without warning. Typically, IMSI catchers are used at large rallies, allowing law enforcement to later identify who was in attendance, particularly if those individuals were actively calling others to join in. Devices like these can also be used by commuting services and apps to create traffic reports. Here, the actual account number, or IMSI, doesn't matter, only how fast your cell phone moves from tower to tower or geographic region to geographic region. The amount of time it takes a cell phone to come and go from each tower determines the traffic status, red, yellow, or green. Your mobile device connects to a series of cellular towers whenever it's powered up. The closest tower actually handles your call, text, or internet session. As you move around, your phone pings the nearest tower, and if necessary, your call moves from tower to tower, all the while maintaining consistency. The other nearby towers are all on standby so that if you move from point A to point B and another tower comes into range for a better signal, then the handoff is smooth and you shouldn't experience a dropped call. Suffice it to say that your mobile device emits a unique sequence that is logged on a number of individual cellular towers. So anyone looking at the logs of a specific tower would see the temporary mobile subscriber identity, TMSI, of all the people in the general area at any given moment, whether they made calls or not. Law enforcement can and does request this information from cellular carriers, including the back-end account identities of specific holders. Ordinarily, if you look at just one cell tower's log, the data might only show that someone was passing through and that his or her device contacted a specific cell tower as a standby. If a call was made or if data was exchanged, there would also be a record of that call and its duration. Data from multiple cell tower logs, however, can be used to geographically pinpoint a user. Most mobile devices ping three or more towers at a time. Using logs from those cell towers, someone can triangulate, based on the relative strength of each ping, a fairly exact location of the phone's user. So, the phone you carry around every day is essentially a tracking device. How can you avoid being tracked? Signing a contract with a cell phone carrier requires a name, address, and a social security number. Additionally, there's a credit check to make sure you can pay your monthly bill. You can't avoid this if you go with a commercial carrier. A burner phone seems like a reasonable option. A prepaid cell phone, perhaps one that you replace frequently, say weekly or even monthly, avoids leaving much of a trail. Your TMSI will show up on cell tower logs, then disappear. If you purchased the phone discreetly, it won't be traceable back to a subscriber account. Prepaid cell services are still subscriber accounts, so the IMSI will always be assigned to an account. Therefore, a person's anonymity depends on how he or she acquired the burner device. For the sake of argument, let's assume you have successfully disconnected yourself from the purchase of a burner phone. You followed the steps outlined on page 49 and used a person unrelated to you to purchase the phone for cash. Is the use of that disposable phone untraceable? The short answer is no. Here's a cautionary tale. One afternoon in 2007, a $500 million container loaded with the drug ecstasy went missing from a port in Melbourne, Australia. The owner of the container, Pat Barbaro, a known drug dealer, reached into his pocket, pulled out one of his 12 cell phones, and dialed the number of a local reporter, Nick McKenzie, who would only know the caller by the name Stan. Barbaro would later use his other burner phones to text McKenzie, attempting to anonymously obtain information from the investigative reporter about the missing container. As we will see, this didn't work. Burner phones, despite what many people may think, are not truly anonymous. Under the U.S. Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, CALEA, all IMSIs connected with burner phones are reported, just as those subscribers under contract with major carriers are. In other words, a law enforcement official can spot a burner phone from a log file just as easily as he can spot a registered contract phone. While the IMSI won't identify who owns the phone, patterns of usage might. In Australia, where CALEA does not exist, law enforcement was still able to keep tabs on Barbaro's many phones using rather traditional methods. For instance, they might have noticed a call made with his personal phone and then, a few seconds later, seen in the log files, another call or text from one of his burner phones in the same cell site. Over time, the fact that these IMSIs more often than not appeared together on the same cell sites might suggest that they belonged to a single individual. The problem with Barbaro's having many cell phones at his disposal was that no matter which phone he used, personal or burner, so long as he stayed in the same spot, the signal would hit the same cellular tower. The burner phone calls always appeared next to his registered phone calls. The registered phone, listed in his name with a carrier, was entirely traceable and helped law enforcement identify him. It established a solid case against him, particularly because this pattern was repeated at other locations. This helped Australian authorities convict Barbaro of orchestrating one of the largest ecstasy shipments in Australia's history. McKenzie concluded, "Ever since the phone buzzed that day in my pocket and Stan briefly entered my life, I've been especially conscious about how a person's communications leave a trail, no matter how careful they are." You could, of course, have only a burner phone. This would mean that you would need to purchase additional minutes anonymously using prepaid cards of Bitcoin from time to time, which you can do by using an open Wi-Fi safely after changing your media access control, MAC address on your wireless card, and being out of any camera view. Or you could, as suggested in the previous chapter, hire a stranger to pay cash at the store to purchase the prepaid phone and several refill cards. This adds cost and perhaps inconvenience, but you would have an anonymous phone. Although it may seem brand new, cellular technology is more than 40 years old, and it, like copper wire telephone systems, contains legacy technologies that can compromise your privacy. Each generation of cell phone technology has offered new features, mostly intended to move more data more efficiently. First-generation phones, or 1G, had the telephone technology available in the 1980s. These early 1G networks and handsets were analog-based, and they used a variety of now discontinued mobile standards. In 1991, the second-generation 2G digital network was introduced. This 2G network offered two standards: Global System for Mobile Communications, GSM, and Code Division Multiple Access, CDMA. It also introduced Short Message Service, SMS, Unstructured Supplementary Services Data, USSD, and other simple communications protocols that are still in use today. We're currently in the middle of 4G LTE and on the way toward 5G. No matter what generation of technology a given carrier is using, 2G, 3G, 4G, or 4G LTE, there is an underlying international signal protocol known as the signaling system. The signaling system protocol, currently in version 7, among other things, keeps mobile calls connected when you drive along a freeway and switch from cell tower to cell tower. It can also be used for surveillance. Signaling System 7, SS7, does basically everything necessary to route a call, such as setting up a new connection for a call, tearing down that connection when the call ends, billing the appropriate party making the call, managing extra features such as call forwarding, calling party name and number display, three-way calling and other intelligent network IN services, toll-free 800 and 888 as well as toll 900 calls, wireless services including subscriber identification, carrier, and mobile roaming. Speaking at the Chaos Communication Congress, an annual computer hacker conference held in Berlin, Germany, Tobias Engel, founder of Sternraut, and Carsten Knoll, chief scientist for Security Research Labs, explained that they could not only locate cell phone callers anywhere in the world, they could also listen in on their phone conversations. And if they couldn't listen in real time, they could record the encrypted calls and texts for later decryption. In security, you are only as secure as the weakest link. What Engel and Knoll found was that while developed countries in North America and Europe have invested billions in creating relatively secure and private 3G and 4G networks, they must still use Signaling System 7, SS7, as an underlying protocol. SS7 handles the process for call establishment, billing, routing, and information exchange functions, which means if you can tap into SS7, you can manipulate the call. SS7 allows an attacker to use a small carrier in, say, Nigeria, to access calls made in Europe or the United States. It's like you secure the front door of the house, but the back door is wide open, said Engel. The two researchers tested a method in which an attacker uses a phone's call forwarding function and SS7 to forward a target's outgoing calls to himself before conferencing, three-way calling, in their intended recipient. Once the attacker has established himself, he can listen to all calls made by the targeted individual from any place on Earth. Another strategy would be for the attacker to set up radio antennas to collect all cellular calls and texts within a given area. For any encrypted 3G calls, the attacker could ask SS7 to provide him with the proper decryption key. It's all automated, at the push of a button, Knoll said. It would strike me as a perfect spying capability to record and decrypt pretty much any network. Any network we have tested, it works. He then enumerated almost every major carrier in North America and Europe, around 20 in all. Knoll and Engel also found that they could locate any cell phone user by using an SS7 function called an anytime interrogation query. That is, they could do so until the function was shut down early in 2015. However, since all carriers must track their users in order to provide service, SS7 provides other functions that still allow some remote surveillance. It should be noted that the specific flaws identified by Knoll and Engel have been mostly mitigated by the carriers since their research went public. You might think that encryption alone would help keep cell phone calls private. Beginning with 2G, GSM-based phone calls have been encrypted. However, the initial methods used to encrypt calls in 2G were weak and eventually broke down. Unfortunately, the cost of upgrading cellular networks to 3G proved prohibitive for many carriers, so a weakened 2G remained in use until around 2010 or so. In the summer of 2010, a team of researchers led by Knoll divided all the possible encryption keys used by 2G GSM networks among themselves and crunched the numbers to produce what's called a rainbow table, a list of pre-computed keys or passwords. They published the table to show carriers around the world just how insecure 2G encryption using GSM is. Each packet or unit of data between source and destination, a voice, text, or data sent over 2G GSM, could be decrypted in just a few minutes using the published table of keys. This was an extreme example, but the team considered it necessary. When Knoll and others had previously presented their findings to the carriers, their warnings fell on deaf ears. By demonstrating how they could crack 2G GSM encryption, they more or less forced the carriers to make the change. It is important to note that 2G still exists today, and carriers are considering selling access to their old 2G networks for use in Internet of Things devices, devices other than computers that connect to the Internet, such as your TV and refrigerator, which only need occasional data transmission. If this happens, we will need to make sure the devices themselves have end-to-end encryption because we know that 2G will not provide strong enough encryption by itself. Of course, eavesdropping existed before mobile devices really took off. For Anita Bush, the nightmare started the morning of June 20th, 2002, when she awoke to a neighbor's urgent knock on her door. Someone had put a bullet hole in the windshield of her car as it sat in the driveway. Not only that, someone had also left Bush a rose, a dead fish, and a one-word note, "Stop," on the car's hood. Later, she would learn that her phones had been tapped, and not by law enforcement. The fact that the scene with a bullet hole and a dead fish was reminiscent of a bad Hollywood gangster movie made some sense. Bush, a seasoned reporter, was at the time only a few weeks into a freelance assignment chronicling organized crime's growing influence in Hollywood for the Los Angeles Times. She was researching Steven Seagal and his former business partner, Julius R. Nasso, who had been indicted for conspiring with the New York Mafia to extort money from Seagal. What followed finding the note on her car was a series of phone messages. The caller apparently wanted to share some information about Seagal. Much later, Bush learned that the caller had been hired by Anthony Pelicano, a former high-profile Los Angeles private investigator who, at the time Bush's car was tampered with, was already suspected by the FBI of illegal wiretapping, bribery, identity theft, and obstruction of justice. Bush's copper wire phone had been tapped by Pelicano, who knew by eavesdropping on her calls that she was writing a newspaper story about his clients. The fish head on her car was an attempt to warn her off. Typically, wiretapping is only associated with phone calls, but wiretapping laws in the United States can also cover eavesdropping on email and instant messages. For the moment, I'll focus on wiretapping's traditional use in copper wire landlines. Landlines are the hardwired phones in your home or business, and wiretapping involves literally tapping into the live wire. Back in the day, phone companies each had physical banks of switches on which they performed a version of wiretapping. What that means is that the phone company had special appliances that the frame techs hooked up to the target phone number on the mainframe in the central office. There is additional wiretapping equipment that dials into this appliance and is used to monitor the target. Today, that way of eavesdropping is retired. Phone companies are all required to implement the technical requirements mandated by CALEA. Although a growing number of people today have shifted to mobile phones, many still retain their landlines for their copper wire dependability. Others use what's called Voice over Internet Protocol, VOIP technology, which is telephony over the Internet and usually bundled in the home or office with your cable or Internet service. Whether it's a physical switch at the phone company or a digital switch, law enforcement does have the ability to eavesdrop on calls. The 1994 CALEA requires telecommunications manufacturers and carriers to modify their equipment for the purposes of allowing law enforcement to wiretap the line. So, under CALEA, any landline call in the United States is theoretically subject to interception. And under CALEA, all law enforcement access requires a Title III warrant. That said, it's still illegal for an ordinary citizen to conduct a wiretap, which is what Anthony Pelicano did to covertly monitor Anita Bush and others. His list of eavesdropping victims happens to include Hollywood celebrities such as Sylvester Stallone, David Carradine, and Kevin Nealon, among others. His list of wiretap victims also includes my friend Erin Finn, because her ex-boyfriend was obsessed with her and wanted to track her every move. Because her phone line had been tapped, I too was monitored when I called her. The coolest part of the saga is that AT&T paid me thousands of dollars as part of a class action settlement because of Pelicano's wiretapping of my calls to Finn, which is somewhat ironic because, on another occasion, I was the one doing the tapping. Pelicano's purpose in wiretapping people was perhaps more malicious than mine. He was trying to intimidate witnesses into either not testifying or testifying in a certain way. Back in the mid-1990s, a wiretap had to be installed by technicians. So Pelicano or one of his people had to hire someone who worked at Pac Bell to tap Bush's and Finn's telephone lines. The technicians were able to set up extensions of the target phones at Pelicano's office in Beverly Hills. In this case, there were no taps done at the junction box or the terminal at the side of the house or apartment complex, although that is also possible. As you may recall from reading my previous book, Ghost in the Wires, I once drove down from my father's apartment in Calabasas to Long Beach to set up a physical wiretap on a phone line used by Kent, a friend of my late brother. There were many questions surrounding my brother's death from a drug overdose, and I believed he had a part in that death, though I later learned he was not involved. In the utility space within the apartment complex where Kent lived, I used social engineering to pretend to be a line technician calling a particular unit within GTE, General Telephone and Electronics, to find where the cable and pair assigned to Kent's phone were located. It turned out that Kent's phone wires ran through a completely separate apartment building. And so, in a second utility space, I was ultimately able to clip my voice-activated micro-cassette tape recorder to his phone line at the terminal box, the place where phone company technicians connect the lines to each apartment. After that, any time Kent made a call, I could record both sides of the conversation without his knowing I was doing so. Though I should note that while the recordings were in real time, my listening to them was not. Every day over the next 10 days, I had to make the 60-minute drive to Kent's apartment, afterward listening to the retrieved tapes for any mention of my brother. Unfortunately, nothing ever came of it. Years later, I learned that my uncle had likely been responsible for my brother's death. Given how easy it was for Pelicano and me to tap into private phone conversations, you may wonder how you can become invisible with a copper wire landline phone that is apparently open to surveillance. You can't, without buying special equipment. For the truly paranoid, there are landline phones that will encrypt all your voice conversations over copper wires. These phones do solve the problem of interception of private phone calls, but only if both ends of the call use encryption. Otherwise, they may be easy to monitor. For the rest of us, there are some basic telephone choices we can make to avoid being eavesdropped on. The move toward digital telephony has made surveillance easier, not harder. Today, if a tap is necessary on a digital phone line, it can be done remotely. The switching computer simply creates a second parallel stream of data. No additional monitoring equipment is required. This also makes it much harder to determine whether a given line has been tapped, and in most cases, such taps are only discovered by accident. Shortly after Greece hosted the 2004 Summer Olympics, engineers at Vodafone Panafone removed some rogue software that had been discovered to be running in the company's cellular network for more than a year. In practice, law enforcement intercepts all voice and text data sent over any cellular network through a remote-controlled system called RES, Remote Control Equipment Subsystem, the digital equivalent of an analog wiretap. When a subject under surveillance makes a mobile call, the RES creates a second data stream that feeds directly to a law enforcement officer. The rogue software discovered in Greece tapped into Vodafone's RES, meaning that someone other than a legitimate law enforcement officer was listening to conversations conducted over its cellular network. In this case, the wiretapper was interested in government officials. During the Olympics, some countries, such as the United States and Russia, provided their own private communications systems for state-level conversations. Other heads of state and business executives from around the world used the compromised Vodafone system. An investigation showed that the communications of the Greek prime minister and his wife, as well as those of the mayor of Athens, the Greek European Union commissioner, and the ministries of national defense, foreign affairs, the mercantile marine, and justice had been monitored during the Olympics. Other intercepted phones belonged to members of civil rights organizations, anti-globalization groups, the ruling New Democracy Party, the Hellenic Navy General Staff, as well as peace activists and a Greek-American employee at the United States Embassy in Athens. The spying might have continued longer had Vodafone not called in the hardware vendor for its RES system, Ericsson, while investigating a separate complaint that its text messages were suffering delivery failures at a higher-than-normal rate. After diagnosing the problem, Ericsson notified Vodafone that it had found rogue software. Unfortunately, more than a decade afterward, we still don't know who did this, or why, or even how common this activity might be. To make matters worse, Vodafone apparently mishandled the investigation. For one thing, key log files covering the event were missing, and instead of letting the rogue program run after discovery, a common practice in computer criminal investigations, Vodafone abruptly removed it from their system, which may have tipped off the perpetrators and allowed them to further cover their tracks. The Vodafone case is an unsettling reminder of how vulnerable our cell phones are to interception. But there are ways you can still be invisible with a digital phone. Besides cell phones and old-fashioned landlines, a third telephony option, as I mentioned earlier, is Voice over Internet Protocol, VOIP. VOIP is great for any wireless device that lacks a native means of making a phone call, e.g., an Apple iPod Touch. It's more like surfing the internet than making a classic phone call. Landlines require copper wire. Mobile phones use cell towers. VOIP is simply transmitting your voice over the internet, either using wired or wireless internet services. VOIP also works on mobile devices, such as laptops and tablets, whether or not they have cellular service. To save money, many homes and offices have switched to the VOIP systems being offered by new service providers and existing cable companies. VOIP uses the same coaxial cable that brings streaming video and high-speed internet into your home. The good news is that VOIP phone systems do use encryption, specifically something called Session Description Protocol Security Descriptions, or SDES. The bad news is that on its own, SDES is not very secure. Part of the problem with SDES is the encryption key is not shared over SSL-TLS, a network cryptographic protocol, which is secure. If the vendor doesn't use SSL-TLS, however, then the key is sent in the clear. Instead of asymmetric encryption, it uses symmetric encryption, which means that the key generated by the sender must somehow be passed to the recipient in order for the call to be unscrambled. Let's say Bob wants to make a call to Alice, who is in China. Bob's SDES-encrypted VOIP phone generates a new key for that call. Somehow, Bob has to get that new key to Alice so her VOIP equipment can decrypt his phone call and they can have a conversation. The solution SDES offers is to send the key to Bob's carrier, which then passes it to Alice's carrier, which then shares it with her. Do you see the flaw? Remember what I said about end-to-end encryption in the previous chapter? The conversation stays secure until the recipient opens it at the other end. But SDES shares the key from Bob to Bob's carrier, and if Alice's carrier is different, the call is encrypted from Alice's carrier to Alice. Whether the gap is significant is debatable. Something like this also happens with Skype and Google Voice. New keys are generated whenever a call is initialized, but those keys are then given over to Microsoft and Google. So much for wanting to have a private conversation. Fortunately, there are ways to encrypt mobile VOIP from end to end. Signal, an application from OpenWhisper Systems, is a free open-source VOIP system for mobile phones that provides true end-to-end encryption for both iPhone and Android. The main advantage of using Signal is that the key management is handled only between the calling parties, not through any third party. That means that, as in SDES, new keys are generated with each call. However, the only copies of the keys are stored on the user's devices. Since CALEA allows access to any record of a specific call, law enforcement would in this case only see the encrypted traffic across the mobile carrier's line, which would be unintelligible. And OpenWhisper Systems, the nonprofit organization that makes Signal, does not have the keys, so a warrant would be useless. The keys exist only on the devices at either end of the call, and once the call ends, those session keys are destroyed. Currently, CALEA does not extend to end users or their devices. You might think that having encryption on your cell phone would drain your battery. It does, but not by much. Signal uses push notifications, as do the apps WhatsApp and Telegram. Thus, you only see a call when it is incoming, which cuts down on battery use while you're listening for new calls. The Android and iOS apps also use audio codecs and buffer algorithms native to the mobile network. So again, the encryption is not draining a lot of power while you're making a call. In addition to using end-to-end encryption, Signal also use perfect forward secrecy, PFS. What is PFS? It's a system that uses a slightly different encryption key for every call so that even if someone does manage to get hold of your encrypted phone call and the key that was used to encrypt it, your other calls will remain secure. All PFS keys are based on a single original key. But the important thing is that if someone compromises one key, it doesn't mean your potential adversary has access to your further communications.